So back to Grand Rapids in 1900 with Lawrence Rossman. He writes, railroad ties cut in this county were hewed by hand from either tamarack or cedar timber, with a very few oak ties being made in certain sections. Tie cutters were a class of timber workers by themselves, for not every man could swing a 10 or 12 pound broadaxe all day and hew out the number of ties necessary if wages were to be made. Tie cutting has always been known as peacemaking, and for many years the standard price for making ties was 10 cents. For this, the cutter had to fall the tree, hew it on two sides smooth enough to pass a critical inspection and down to a reasonable thickness, then saw it into 8-foot lengths and drag them into piles, plus swamping a skidding trail to the piles. Some tie makers became unusually skilled in the use of the broadaxe. Up in the Big Fork Valley, they still talk about Sam Blake, who hewed ties in several camps at an unusual speed. One winter, he cut and piled 3,000 tamarack ties, standard width and average 50 ties per day at that 10 cents each. On a wager with good timber, Blake had been known to cut down the trees, hew and saw off, but not pile, 85 ties in a day. Boy, talk about hard work and grueling work. And we learn about an important service that was available when it came to cutting down trees. Anything to do with that, always of prime interest in Grand Rapids. Rossman writes, men who used axes were supposed to be able to keep them sharp and generally were successful, knowing that the work could be done much easier with sharp cutting edges. Each night, the big camp grindstone in the back of the bunkhouse was kept busy, one man turning it for another to hold the axe blade where it would be ground sharp, then finished to a razor edge with a hand stone by the more particular choppers. Crosscut saws were filed and set by an expert, that work not being left to the men who worked with the saws. The saw filer worked out in the woods where the trees were being sawed down, taking a newly sharpened saw to a pair of sawyers and carrying the dull blade to a filing stand made from two small tree stumps near at hand. This saw, again in condition, the filer went on to the next pair of sawyers and so on until he'd made the complete rounds. To keep pine pitch from accumulating on the saw blade and making the work harder, each pair of sawyers carried a small bottle of kerosene and at frequent intervals spilled a few drops on the saw blade. Camp Wanigans in the old days carried clothing for the men, including socks, mittens, underwear, woolen jackets, top rubbers, and other things needed to protect the men from the cold. Here also was carried the supply of tobacco for the men, and when supplies had to be carried long distances by sleighs, it was necessary that a good supply of both smoking and chewing tobacco be always at hand. Men might wear clothes which were ventilated because of holes torn in the brush, or they might stand it a few days if some article of food was lacking. But if the supply of tobacco was allowed to become exhausted, that camp would be out of men in a few days. Strong smoking tobacco was the rule. Such brands as Peerless, True Smoke, La Turque, Union Leader, and some kinds of cut plug were most popular. Early day chewing tobacco brands included Climax and Horseshoe Plug, with a few brands not so well known. Snuff was used very little in the first logging operations. Copenhagen snuff came into general use in logging camps about the time that many men of Scandinavian ancestry began to come into the woods. Cigarettes were unknown in camp 40 years ago. To use them was considered the trait of a sissy, and some foremen have been known to fire a man found using them while at work. In the early 1900s, Rossman writes, the only coal stove in Grand Rapids was probably the one located in the depot. Every home was heated with wood, and every meal was cooked with that fuel. Even the village power and light plant located on the shore of Hale Lake used wood for fuel, and large quantities were purchased for that place. The King Lumber Company shipped in the first carload of coal for use in heating homes, this being hard coal for the base burners, which a number of men with means were installing in their places. In 1920, it was predicted that no more wood could be used for heating in Grand Rapids, for all within hauling distance had been cut. About that time, the farmers began buying trucks, and immediately the distance for wood hauling was extended from a maximum of 12 miles to 40 or 50, and wood was once more plentiful. Lots of wood burned in Grand Rapids over many years. I did my share of that, too. And here's another from Rossman. Perhaps many people who read the stories of the lumberjack believe that these mighty men of the woods spent most of their money for strong drink and tobacco. The truth is that they were large users of fresh fruit when they could buy it, and they also liked candy in large quantities. While the lumberjacks did make large investments in snuff and whiskey, they also bought the fruit and candy. A barrel of apples would be opened in the morning, and by night it would be all gone in small sales of six or a dozen. Candy was bought in pails, and great quantities would be on hand. While tradition might describe the lumberjack with a bottle on his hip, it could also describe him as a man with a bag of candy in his Mackinac pocket. The ordinary fare in lumber camps did not provide fresh fruit and candy. That was the reason for the demand. We get another glance from Rossman of gambling in Grand Rapids in 1900. He writes, Grand Rapids had several gambling places, most of them connected with saloons, and a good many people made most of their living from their card-playing ability. The visitor in Grand Rapids would have found plenty of chances to lose his money. If he'd stepped into a saloon, he would have seen on one side a row of slot machines from a nickel to a dollar. Passing back further, he might have found a gambling table or two and a roulette wheel. Sometimes some pretty big games would be in progress, though nothing as spectacular as might have been found in other sections. But $1,000 would be seen quite often on the table. Most of the sums, however, were considerably smaller, as a large number of those who played did not get into the big money class. The games that were played were those which were common to most gamblers. Stud and draw poker were most common. Blackjack, which those who read Western tales know most about, was seldom played here. But there were several other card games which are more or less native to a section and in which some particular group excelled. There were some games with dice. Particularly important was the game of Klondike, played with dice on a table. In this game, money could be lost quite rapidly. And one more time, we'll return to Lawrence Rossman in the next program.